Hello, this is Rabble Radio, recorded on Friday, February 21st, 2025. I'm Breanne Doyle. Rabble.ca shares with you the news of the day through a progressive lens. If you're curious about what's happening in Canadian politics, labor, environment, and beyond, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us. Thanks for tuning in. This week we share a clip from the latest episode of the Courage My Friends podcast series. In this episode, host Resh Bidou sat down with author and storyteller Carolyn Roberts, Dean of the Center for Preparatory and Liberal Studies at George Brown College, Susan Toews, and the Director of Student Well-being and Support at George Brown College, Alex Irwin, to discuss this year's upcoming mental health conference. This year's conference theme is Thriving Together in the Classroom, Creating the Conditions for Student Well-being. Here is a clip of that conversation. Take a listen.
Why is a focus on mental health so crucial to the well-being of today's post-secondary students? How can faculty and staff address the growing needs of students, and what pressures are they experiencing? What are systemic issues facing Indigenous educators and learners? And how can we create decolonized, inclusive, and healthy spaces of learning where all can thrive? I'm your host, Resh Bidou. Carolyn, Susan, and Alex, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Nice to be here.
Thanks for having me.
So on February 27th, Toronto's George Brown College is holding its 25th annual mental health conference. Susan, tell us about this year's conference theme.
So this year we're focusing on teaching. This conference has a really long history. So this is our 25th annual mental health conference, and it's really evolved over the years. And I would say the last 3 or 4 years, we've even more intentionally focused on students. So last year, we focused on international students. The year before, the focus was on the national standard for post-secondary mental health. And this year, we're really focusing on teaching. We know that teachers play such an important role in students' well-being and sense of confidence and what they can accomplish and if they belong in the program on campus and at the college. They wield a lot of power, I think, and for good. And so this year, we're bringing out a lot of teachers, a lot of professors at the college are going to be giving a range of sessions. We have 12 different sessions to choose from around empathy and curriculum, humanizing the classroom, anti-racism and well-being, using UDL learning to enhance student well-being, and so on. And we have the wonderful Carolyn Roberts talking about decolonizing learning. And then in the afternoon, we're going to have a panel talking about the connection between student learning and student well-being, and what do post-secondary college teachers really need to know? How can they really positively impact student well-being?
Thank you for that. And this is in person, correct?
Yes, it's okay. In person, one day.
And it is focused on teaching, but can anybody attend?
Oh, absolutely. And we have workshops for everyone. So, of course, Carolyn's keynote will be appealing to everyone and the panel in the afternoon. And then the sessions, we have one on employee well-being delivered by manager of employee wellness in HR, and quite a range. So not every workshop is on teaching. They're all relevant to teaching, but also relevant to support staff, administrators, and also external community members.
Carolyn, as Susan mentioned, you are delivering the keynote address again on decolonizing learning. And this has really been the focus of much of your work. And you wear many hats. So you are faculty at the University of British Columbia, but you're also a storyteller, facilitator, and author. Just last year saw the publication of your book, Restoring Education, Decolonizing Your Practice Using a Critical Lens. So first of all, tell us more about your work and what drives your passion in looking at education from this perspective.
Good question. So yes, I wear many hats. And most of the work that I've been doing in the past 6 years is teaching teachers. So I work with pre-service teachers before they head out into the system. And a lot of my work revolves around how do we do work in Indigenous education and how do we start decolonizing the spaces that we are in. So the book came out of all of the work that I was doing with presentations and working with educators about how they can step into their practice. That's where my focus is of all the work that I do. And I think the passion that comes behind it is that I really want to be able to change the system for students who don't see themselves within the system. And how do we encompass all learners in our classroom? And how do we make sure that the next generation comes out of our education system actually knowing the true shared colonial history of this place that's known as Canada today are really a lot of the factors that allow me to do the work that I do and feed my passions.
Could you give us a bit of an introduction to your upcoming keynote in terms of, for those who don't know, what do you mean by decolonizing or restoring learning?
Well, the term restoring has come a lot through an Indigenous perspective of storytelling, and I am a storyteller. And I find that when I go and I do this work, people really connect with how we engage others. And through story, we can engage others with personal anecdotes or ways that we have done the work in order to help support other people to do their work. So when I think about restoring, it really is starting to tell a different narrative of what we have been taught. So the talk will go through some many different paths of how the education system is for Indigenous students within it, and then how we can start as educators and even just citizens of Canada. How can we step into the work to make sure that we are re-educating ourselves about the untold histories that we haven't been taught in our education system? So when I say restoring, it just means let's start to tell the story of this place, the shared story of this place together. So I go through some history. I go through some ways that we can do that in our classrooms. I use stories and analogies of my own life, my life with my children, and how I do this work as an educator and have been doing this work as an educator for a lot of years.
I can already tell that this is going to generate a lot of discussion because there is so much to talk about from the different experiences that are also coming from within the classroom as well. And again, this year marks the 25th anniversary of the Mental Health Conference. I think it says that it is a special 25th anniversary edition of the conference. And Alex, why is a focus on mental health so crucial to post-secondary education?
Well, I think it's always been so crucial, but I think in this moment, it's particularly so. We see, of course, lots of data and indicators that our students are having a rough time. And I think that manifests in terms of just straight up numbers of visits to our core services, which have gone up pretty dramatically in the last couple of years. So it's a very important moment. And I also think it's an important moment because we're looking at, as Susan has said, and I really feel as Carolyn has said as well, and really resonates what she's talking about in terms of social connection and inclusion and belonging in the classroom. I feel like we're heading towards the whole campus approach to our students' well-being and the well-being of our employees. And in that way, I think we're just looking at the whole experience for our students. So the moment's important because it's a hard moment. There's immense pressures that our students are under. The ones in the past that we've always had jobs and family and social dislocation if you're an international student, but then also other pressures in the world right now that are very, very hard for our students. So we are stepping up with as robust as services as we can on campus in terms of traditional counseling services and our accessible learning services, which works a lot with students on mental health issues, and Peer Mentor Plus, which is a wellness-focused peer service, at the same time as we're really trying to be at the forefront, working with all our colleagues across the college, and particularly in the classroom, on fostering a sense of belonging and community and all of those important things so that perhaps students don't need some of the front-facing services as much because they get that sense of inclusion in those spaces.
Right. And as Director of Student Wellbeing and Support, you're sort of ideally placed within that intersection between learning and mental health and all of the supports that are needed. Will we be hearing from students at the conference as well?
Yes, yes, we will. In fact, our MC is a student, which is very exciting this year for the first time. We also will have students attending the conference, students working at the conference as volunteers. And then at the end of the day in the program, we will have a panel of students and faculty to discuss the classroom experience and mental health generally, which we're very excited about.
And Susan, from the vantage point of a college dean, could you add to what Alex was saying in terms of some of the key factors that you're seeing impacting student mental health and well-being and teachers at this point?
Well, I think what we see is so much pressure on students these days. Post-secondary education is so expensive. Living in the city is so expensive. Everybody is worried about where their program will lead them in terms of employment. And particularly for international students, there's just an incredible amount of pressure, time pressure, pressure to succeed. Definitely faculty feel that often from students as well. And when their students find themselves in desperate situations where they feel they need to pass a course or so much is riding on whether or not they pass and they're on visas and restrictions and may need to return home and so many different pressures. So I think everybody is feeling it and everything that's going on in the world today, which we probably won't even touch on, but it's adding to the sense of what is our future all about. So I think students bring that to the classroom and to courses, and our teachers are so incredibly dedicated and care so much, and it comes up in class discussions, sometimes requests for informal accommodations. And I think teachers these days are balancing a huge amount of individual requests from students as well as formal accommodations through the Accessible Learning Services office, trying to get through the course, the content, and help students reach the outcomes in a very short period, 15 weeks. It's an enormous amount of pressure. We have much more of an understanding now of the environmental impacts on our well-being. And I think back to years ago with the conference, there was much more of a focus on illness and talking about understanding mental illness. And we really have shifted, the whole conversation in society has shifted, which is great, to more on understanding the environmental impacts on health and mental health just being part of our overall health and physical and mental health being connected and everything that happens, including, as Carolyn and Alex are talking about, how much you feel you belong on campus, whether you have a friend, whether you feel like in the classroom you're seen and heard, whether your voice matters, all of that has an impact on our well-being and our mental health. And so teachers, I think, carry a lot of responsibility. And so we're hoping to both showcase their incredible skill at George Brown and passion. And also we hope that people will leave the conference with maybe a few new ideas on how they can do things a little differently.
Right. And, you know, again, in terms of those social factors, I mean, we can go a little bit into them because just the 2020s alone have been wild, as we've all been experiencing. COVID, conflict, as you mentioned, the situation facing international students, the housing crisis, the cost of living. Students really are not just students at the post-secondary level. So many of them are also workers. They're also balancing families. There's so much that's going on in their lives. And Carolyn, you're coming at this from the faculty perspective as well. And again, all of this translates into the classroom. You are one of those frontline workers who are dealing with this every day. So could you speak to that in terms of what you are seeing in the classroom and how you're dealing with it?
Yeah. And as you're talking, I was just thinking of how it has changed over time, even from when I was in post-secondary getting my teaching degree, how the system had been set up like a full-time one-year program and the option to work wasn't an option because it was a full-time program. But now when I'm teaching the students and understanding that the program's still a one-year program, but students are still having to work and having to balance outside life and the life at school, there's a lot of things and a lot of it has to do with how expensive things are, how expensive it is to live in the city, and then just juggling, trying to get everything done within it. And I think that the pressures really do take a mental toll on us. And maybe it wasn't something that was as talked about before, but it is definitely talked about now. And how can we better support? And I think that a lot of the work that I do is about slowing down the pace, at least in my personal classrooms, setting up the intention that we're building a community here and that we have that opportunity to have conversations and connections with other people rather than just pushing through all the work that needs to get done by the end of the semester, but really creating that sense of community for students so that they feel like they do belong, that their voice does matter, and that they personally matter within the course are all things that I think about as an educator, especially in today's classrooms, that there's a lot of other things going on as well.
Today's classrooms are also just looking so different with the advent of technology and the learning curve that has to happen there and the resourcing and whatnot. I mean, there's a lot going on. The social factors impacting them, personal factors that are impacting them, but also the deeply embedded and systemic factors that tend to impact different groups differently. And therefore, you know, what we've been saying about belonging being so important. And Carolyn, your work is focused on confronting and transforming the colonial nature of education. So could you go a bit more into that? First of all, how are educational systems colonial systems? And how do they harm the mental health of particularly Indigenous and racialized students?
Well, when we think about the system was really created and built for a certain demographic of students to be successful. And within that, we were not told the stories of Indigenous people. And when I talk about this, I really talk about when I personally was in my master's program, because prior to my master's program, I didn't have any Indigenous authors, Indigenous scholars, or Indigenous educators. So I never saw a reflection of who I was within these spaces that were supposed to be teaching us all about the world around us. But they only ever told us one narrative of the world around us, and it didn't include many voices, many stories from many different perspectives. It told us one. So when Indigenous students step into the classroom, we are being asked to leave a part of who we are at the door because that's not talked about or shared within those spaces. So we have to leave our indigeneity at the door to come in to learn about something else. And that's not a sustainable thing. And not only for Indigenous students, but for all non-white students that are walking into these spaces, it's not sustainable for us to leave our culture at the door to be able to come in and learn. We can't. It's a difficult and challenging thing to be able to do. And when I stepped into my master's program, it was a program that was with my nation, the Squamish Nation, and UBC. It was a joint program. And we had all Indigenous professors. We read all Indigenous scholars and works, and we had conversations about Indigenous education and Indigenous people that we could actually connect with and have a conversation about because we've come from that lived experience and understanding. So out of the 12 people that graduated from our master's program, 8 of us are in educational leadership positions because we had the moment in time where we got to be able to see who we were and connect with who we are. And that's a lot about what I talk about within our classrooms. We need to make sure that we're having multiple stories from multiple perspectives in our classrooms so that all of our students can see a piece of them within the work that they're doing.
Wonderful. And this is something that has pervaded, obviously, not just the post-secondary level of education, but all levels of education, to the extent that many Indigenous and racialized people don't actually make it to the post-secondary level. So this is fantastic that so many out of your program have gone into teaching, because another part of the systemic racism that we've been seeing is a lack of hiring from these communities into the teaching profession, especially in higher education. Could you just go a bit more into what you mean by Indigenous resurgence through education? How should faculty and not just faculty, but post-secondary institutions approach this?
Well, when I think about resurgence, I'm really thinking about how are we setting up the next generation to be able to succeed and do well within it. So that means that institutions need to be able to take the time, like today I'm heading in to work after because we're doing a book club. And we've taken a bunch of different Indigenous authors, and together as a group, we're having conversations. So the faculty and the staff are taking the opportunity to learn more and to understand more from an Indigenous perspective, and then talk about how are we going to put that into practice? Because it's not just about adding an Indigenous reading to your syllabus, and it's not just about maybe sharing a book from one lesson within your syllabus. It's really how do we embed this in the work that we do to make sure that we're continually talking about it? And how are we addressing the spaces within the work that we do that are clearly just one-sided spaces, right? If all the readings that we're going to do in the class all come from white males, whose perspectives are we listening to in that classroom, right? So how are we engaging with changing that piece of it to make sure that we have multiple different voices from multiple different perspectives, worldviews, and cultures within our space? And then how are we able to teach that? So taking time to be able to unlearn and relearn, and then really understand how to do this work in those spaces are things that we'll need to do in order for us to be able to get Indigenous students to the point where they're actually coming in and wanting to be teachers. They have to be successful in K-12. And if we don't start to change the things that we're doing, we're never going to change that. Right now in higher education, I think Indigenous faculty is 1% of the faculty across Canada. In BC, there's only 4% of the population that is Indigenous that's teaching. So we have a lot of work to do to be able to create that space and change that for Indigenous people coming up.
Absolutely. And again, you've been doing a great deal of this work, and you've been seeing sort of the positive outcomes of that. So could you perhaps give an example of how this impacts students and the communities that they belong to when they are in this more inclusive and thriving and rejuvenating space of learning?
I don't know if I can speak directly to that. What I do know is that our teacher education program, which is the Indigenous Teacher Ed program, it's called the NITAP program at UBC. There's 28 first-year students, and they're all from Indigenous communities all over, not just in British Columbia, but across Canada. They come to our program specifically because of the type of care that we provide and support for students. We really do a wraparound care. All of the faculty know each other, and we all have conversations of how to best support each student, and the students feel comfortable coming in to share what they need, and we can support them with housing and with food and with counseling and all of those pieces that most universities have as well, but ours is.
That was Carolyn Roberts, Susan Toews, and Alex Irwin in conversation with Courage My Friends host Resh Bidu. To listen to the full episode, tune in to Needs No Introduction, home of the Courage My Friends podcast series. And to register for this year's conference, please visit the link in our show notes. Or, for all of you listening on radio, please visit Rabble Radio on rabble.ca. And now, this is our In Case You Missed It segment, where we review the top stories from this week on rabble.ca. Here to bring us up to date is Rabble editor Nick Seabrook. Over to you, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. Starting with Ontario news. The 2025 provincial election has entered its final week. Leaders from the four major parties held two debates, one focusing exclusively on northern issues, and another focusing on all major topics. All opposition parties took their turns at attacking Doug Ford and his record. From the Greenbelt scandal, to building an underground highway under the 401, to suppressing the wages of public workers, all leaders did their best to discredit the progressive conservative leader. Some had more success than others. Rabble parliamentary reporter Carl Nirenberg notes NDP leader Maritz Stiles seemed more effective in getting her point across than the Liberals' frenetic Bonnie Crombie. Ultimately, Nirenberg notes, even under fire, Ford didn't lose his cool and simply dodged the attacks on his tarnished record. Staying in Ontario news, one of the more controversial moves Ford has taken was restricting the construction of new bike lanes and even attempting to force the City of Toronto to rip out existing ones. Rabble columnist Shreya Kalra notes that while Ford may want to focus on the issue of the trade war with the U.S., public transportation is one of many other important issues in this election. Ford's previously mentioned plan to build a tunnel underneath Highway 401 will cost the taxpayers millions of dollars, while ignoring other methods to reduce traffic congestion in Canada's most populated province. Kalra writes, quote, "The solutions for easing gridlock are not hard or rocket science, but they aren't necessarily sexy enough to catch the public's attention during a snap election. End quote. Turning to labor news. Federal workers are skeptical of a new federal program to replace the troubled Phoenix Pay system. Implemented a decade ago, the Phoenix Pay system was designed to manage payment to federal employees. From the moment of its implementation, though, it caused chaos and disruption in the lives of workers. The Phoenix system withheld pay for some, overpaid others, and missed payments to benefit programs, among other issues. All of these problems are still not fully resolved 10 years later. To replace Phoenix, the federal government is currently trying to roll out a new Dayforce pay system. But the Public Service Alliance of Canada says that workers are not being properly consulted. According to a survey of its members, 40% of respondents said that they do not have faith that the Dayforce program will be any better than Phoenix. In national news, the Liberals have recently presented a new plan to reform funding for Canada's public broadcaster, CBC Radio Canada. In an interview this week, Heritage Minister Pascal Saint-Onge said that her plan would effectively increase public funding for the CBC, reduce reliance on paid advertisers, while also further politically distancing the broadcaster from the federal government. Parliamentary reporter Carl Nirenberg said that while these were good ideas, the time to implement them may have passed. Parliament is currently not sitting, and there is a federal election looming on the horizon. To cap it all off, Saint-Onge herself has announced that she will not be seeking re-election. And finally, NDP MP Charlie Angus was in Brussels this week for a NATO summit. The summit of this military alliance is being held over the backdrop of rising global tensions following the election of Donald Trump as U.S. president. Angus warned leaders at the summit the danger that Trump posed to Canada and the world. In a post on his Substack, Angus writes, quote, "Trump's attacks on Canada is part of a darker plan to destabilize global alliances, plunging us into a much more dangerous world." End quote. As always, you can read the full version of all the stories we talked about today on Rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to Rabble Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on Rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.